Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Fire These Times. In today's episode, we're talking to Justin Salhane, a Beirut-based journalist whose recent essay in Al Jazeera draws comparisons between the 1982 Israeli siege of Beirut with the current ongoing genocide in Gaza. Obviously, in terms of scale, these are two very different events and situations, but the parallels are still relevant and live on in people's memories. And yeah, we just thought it was a really important thing to elaborate on and talk more about. Before we get into all that, I'd like to remind our listeners, if you are interested in this podcast and appreciate the work we do, and you're able to, please consider heading out to patreon.com/firethesetimes and make a donation of as little as $5 a month. It really helps keep this project going and allows us to make more of these episodes for you to enjoy. So, Justin, if you want to introduce yourself.
Hi, Ayman. I'm Justin Salhane. I'm currently based in Beirut, kind of between Beirut and Paris, filing mostly for Al Jazeera at the moment. I'm a freelance journalist covering, I guess you could say, the wider Middle East at this point. And for the last few months, I've been covering kind of the fallout of everything that's been happening after October 7. And as you mentioned, I wrote this piece back in January, or it was released back in January. I did most of the reporting in December. Essentially, the idea was, well, my family had lived through the 82 siege, and I grew up with stories about it. You know, my dad used to tell me stories. He was working as a journalist at the time for United Press International, and my mother was also in town. It was actually the 2 years that she lived in Beirut was 82 to 84. And so I had read an article in the Washington Post from that time period talking about the siege and so many of the things that had happened at that time. If we're talking about attacks on hospitals, about amputations without anesthesia, if we're talking about white phosphorus being dropped on parts of the city, there were just a number of parallels. And it just kind of made me think, you know, there must still be a healthy amount of people around. You know, my parents are no longer with us, unfortunately, but there must be like a good amount of people around that have vivid memories of this time period. So I went around and spoke to a few. And then after you and I had talked about this, which I think was a little over a month ago, we've been trying to make it happen. I went back and started speaking to other folks about, you know, their memories, their experiences, including some of my, or at least one of my dad's old colleagues who told me about one day in particular that I'd, you know, hopefully later we can maybe discuss a bit. But, you know, looking at everything that has been going on in Gaza in the last 4 months, I think it just felt really pertinent to be able to see how so many people in Beirut, and particularly West Beirut, because that's where the siege happened, had lived through similar things, and to have their experiences kind of show that this is not new. This is something that has happened before, and there is an awareness about it, even though there's maybe like a new awareness that a lot of people are coming to this realization now in terms of how, you know, the Israeli military has performed their acts of aggression and have acted in times of war in the past. This is something that a lot of people already know about, though now more people are coming to this. So I thought it was important, you know, to revisit that and to show essentially that there's a long history of this. And even if, you know, I wasn't born in 1982, and I don't think you were either, Ayman, but the memories are there and the history is there and it's well documented. So that was kind of the idea of my article in Al Jazeera. And yeah, hopefully we can kind of dive into those parallels, you know, what West Beirut means to us, the evolution of it, and other topics today.
Yeah, I really appreciated that essay and sort of drawing parallels, not necessarily to compare or to sort of like flatten the history, but to demonstrate, like you said, I thought that was very valuable, the fact that this did not, you know, history did not start on October 7th. And when you look more into the history of Israeli aggressions, things become less surprising. It becomes more daunting. And so, for instance, yeah, so, and also just to say that my parents also grew up in West Beirut, or what was known as West Beirut, during the war. And so seeing this writing is really familiar for me as well. And also uncovering some of this history, because like you said, a lot of us, our parents didn't talk to us. Our parents didn't talk much about the war it's sort of something they wanted to move on from. And specifically, the 1982 siege and Israeli invasion was something that I never really understood the full extent of it until only a few years ago when doing my own research and discovering just how atrocious and how much the Israelis put into it, how many tanks. I think I heard from one UN guy in a documentary that the Israelis had sent in more tanks into Lebanon in 82 than the French army had, period, you know, at all. And obviously this is very relevant today because there is an Israeli aggression on Lebanon and there's constant fears, obviously, that it'll escalate. And just the other day, for those listening, if they don't know, the Israeli aggression escalated in Lebanon. They attacked civilian areas and killing between, I think, 9 to 12 civilians, including 4 children, or I think 6 children. There are sort of different numbers floating around. And yeah, another reason that I appreciate this sort of work and these discussions of what I think Maya Mekdeshi described as like close histories, histories that are very much so still lived, you know, it's our parents, but it's also, if you walk around Beirut, it is still, you can see the war, you can see it, it still exists. Our politicians are still the warlords, you know, it's a very close history that still affects today. Israel still exists and it's still doing its bullshit. I've recently been doing watch parties on documentaries on Palestine, and like even reading or sorry, watching and learning about the Nakba and the lead up to the Nakba and listening to survivor testimonies of, you know, the 47, 48 mass expulsions of Palestinians. It's terrifying how eerily similar, just word for word. And I'll just give you one example. One survivor was talking about how they were mixing animal feed with water to make some sort of bread. And that's something obviously we're seeing in the north of Gaza, where there's this sort of forced starvation of the population. And so, yeah, I think it's really valuable to demonstrate how long this history is, how this current genocide has absolutely nothing to do with Hamas, has kind of nothing to do with October 7th. You know, a lot of it is just pretext, but the history is there. And so, yeah, no, I just wanted to say that I appreciated this article. There's also one last thing that you did write that I thought was really pertinent and terrifying, which is that during the bombing of Beirut in 82, Ronald Reagan called, I think it was Menachem Begin, and told him to stop the bombing. He said, this is a Holocaust. He used the word Holocaust. Yeah, when as right now, Joe Biden, you know what I mean? Like, we've moved so much more hawkish than Ronald Reagan, which is a terrifying prognosis.
Yeah, it really is. And it shows that in the, you know, there have been instances in the past where U.S. administrations have told the Israelis, okay, you know, it ends now, stop. And I think that, you know, we in recent weeks, we've seen things come out from, you know, these different leaks or these different statements talking about how, you know, how every death hurts Anthony Blinken, or how, you know, Biden called Netanyahu an asshole. And it just rings so hollow, you know, nothing materially has been done. And we know that they can do things materially. We know that there is the possibility to put, if not a full stop to this, at least to make it incredibly difficult for this war to continue. But they've done the exact opposite. But they kind of want to play it both ways in the sort of way. So it's incredibly, frustrating is too weak a word here. Right? It's a sort of political ploy to kind of make themselves seem humane, when we know that every action they've taken has been the exact opposite and has done nothing but fuel, you know, what the ICJ is investigating into as a genocide potentially, and what various human rights organizations are calling out with the uttermost horror about. So yeah, I mean, there is precedence in the past, and the 82, you know, the 82 siege was horrible. It was difficult. It was frightening. It was terrifying. What's interesting is talking to people about it now, you know, they will litter it with, you know, their stories with sometimes, well, certain people, depends who you speak to and depends where they were, but, you know, some people talk about how at the time there was a hope, you know, there was a feeling of, you know, maybe the world can change, or maybe we can get out of this, maybe things will happen, right? And I think that the difference between then and today, I don't think anyone in Gaza right now has, you know, the smallest trinkling of hope, or will one day turn around and tell you like a funny story about this period, the way that, you know, some people had shared humorous anecdotes with me. You know, a guy who owns a bookstore told me that Mahmoud Darwish, the famous Palestinian poet, lived, you know, a few blocks down in Hamra and came out on his balcony one night because the bombing was so relentless and started screaming at the warplanes. And he was laughing while telling me the story. You know, I can't imagine the same thing happening in this current conflict. I don't know, Ayman, if you want to maybe outline some of the history of 82, in the sense that, so maybe for listeners who are less familiar with it, to know the kind of historical events that led up to this happening, and then who was, you know, behind the siege and for what reasons or what justifications they gave. I don't know if you want to go over that a little bit.
No, sure. I mean, I don't know if I can do it very well or very concisely, because I'm not a historian, but can I do this?
If you want, I can try to do it like slightly anecdotally, and feel free to jump in. What I can tell you, you know, I'll do it through kind of a familial anecdote. My father at the time was working as a journalist, as I mentioned, and he had asked some, I can't remember exactly who he was talking, some sort of security official in 82, asking, hey, do you think the Israelis are going to invade, because I'm going to invite my girlfriend to come stay with me here. And supposedly the official said no chance. And so my mom, you know, flew in into West Beirut. And a week later, the Israelis invaded through the south. Essentially, their objective was to dislodge the PLO and Yasser Arafat from Lebanon. And so essentially, this was 82, the invasion that invaded the south and made its way all the way up to Beirut. And then they set a siege. It was, I think, about a three-month siege around West Beirut, where the Palestinian forces were based. And then they cut off food and water. And you have anecdotes from people at the time saying, you know, they couldn't get meat. There were things smuggled through. Again, this is another divergence with Gaza today, where at the time, you know, there were people finding ways to get things in. But a lot of times they would say, you know, if there was no flour, we didn't eat any bread. So, you know, the situation today in Gaza is infinitely more severe and worse. But there were people genuinely suffering at this time. And they subjected parts of West Beirut to relentless bombing. A lot of that were areas where, you know, the Palestinians were based in various camps. I spoke to one Palestinian refugee who said that they had to leave their home, and when they came back, just the entire area was essentially demolished. In Hamra, where my parents were based, there weren't many bombings, but there was one at one point, because the Israelis tried to hit the Ministry of Information. And somebody told me they used to do this rounds of four, where they would just kind of tuck, 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 tuck. And there were certain types of attacks that they would particularly fear, because, you know, like from the warplanes, you wouldn't know where it was going to hit. The Israelis at the time supposedly were stationed in Yarze, which is not, you know, just outside Beirut. And so they would say that at times you could hear certain artillery attack come in. And so when you'd hear it being shot, you knew to hit the ground. I had one journalist tell me that that's not what we were afraid of. We weren't afraid of the artillery ones. We were afraid of the warplanes. So essentially, you know, the Israelis put this siege around West Beirut for a few months, until the point where the Palestinians, I think through talking with local militias and politicians, essentially decided, okay, you know, enough is enough. The people here are suffering. The discussions between them, they worked out a deal with the international community, including the US, to leave West Beirut and to take their bases over to Tunis. Of course, after that, you know, the Israeli occupation didn't exactly end. And then we, you know, a month after the PLO had left, there was the Sabra and Shatila massacre. So I think, you know, the importance of knowing this history is also knowing how it connects to today. So obviously, as we already mentioned, there are these parallels between how the Israelis are acting in Gaza today versus how they acted in Beirut at the time. So yeah, I think there's one important aspect here, which is incredibly important, which informs the Israelis' behavior today. There's been a few times where you can see through the rhetoric of Israeli officials, it's almost as if they see Gaza today as they saw Beirut in 82. There's almost this idea that if they bomb the population hard enough in Gaza, people might turn against Hamas. This is what, you know, I think their actions almost show, is that they have this idea that if they hit hard enough, people will turn against Hamas and ask Hamas to leave. Of course, the situation is very different in the sense that the Palestinians were not as much solidarity as they had in West Beirut. They weren't of West Beirut the way that Hamas is of Gaza, or Hezbollah is kind of and part and parcel of and into South Lebanon. And we can talk about why that is and how that is, and maybe, you know, the problematic pitfalls of both of those things. But I think in some part it's inevitable to realize that, and that you cannot just by through sheer force remove this aspect of the society or this party or this actor that comes from the conditions that have been created, you know, essentially through, at least partially, and to a big percentage through Israeli action and behavior. Of course, in 82, we should mention that when the Israelis came in and invaded Lebanon, it also created, it led the steps to the creation of Hezbollah. So I think in a lot of ways, what's happened, or 1982 informs a lot of the Israeli behavior today in terms of how they're acting towards Gaza. It doesn't just show that this has happened before, but it shows sometimes maybe their thought process or why they're doing what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and definitely there's a lot of that same rhetoric. I definitely think there's something really scary about this. It's obviously a lie, because the real goal at the moment, that's just very obvious, is complete ethnic cleansing and land grab in Gaza. But there is a rhetoric of, we're against Hamas, like the Israelis are against Hamas, and that they want people to turn against them, which, even if you take that at face value, is the definition of terrorism. And beyond that, another reason why these historical kind of parallels are really important to point out is because that's what they did in 82. Once they kicked out the PLO, you're right, they elected the fascist Bashir Ismail. You know, he was elected as president of Lebanon on the backs of Israeli tanks, and he was assassinated because he's widely unpopular and hated, not by a Palestinian, by a Lebanese, I forgot his name, of like the Syrian Socialist Nationalist Party. But regardless, and then they did Sabra Shatilo, or rather they orchestrated it alongside the Lebanese forces. And part of the reason that's like one of the most disgusting massacres period, and why it's so remembered, is because there was no one to defend this camp, because all the fighters that could have defended it had left. And so all those left were old men, were women, were children. And
yeah, no, I just wanted to mention that the man that was accused of assassinating Jemayel was Habib Shartouni.
Shartouni,
the SSNP, yeah.
Yeah. I think he's still alive, actually.
Yeah, he is.
So, yeah, the one thing, though, that's really difficult to stomach is how things have changed. And we kind of naturally have a tendency to feel that, like, as history moves on, we become more civilized or whatever. But what we're seeing happening in Gaza is barbaric, is something that, you know, just defies all precedent in terms of, you know, there's so many rules of engagement for urban warfare, where there is like conceptions of minimizing civilian damage and damage of civilian infrastructure, but they're just completely flattening it in a way where they bombed Beirut. They definitely did carpet bombing, but there was still a Beirut to speak of. You know, and what's happening in Gaza is terrifying that it's allowed to happen. And I think it's a really scary thing that obviously we saw as well in Syria only a few years ago. But again, I think it's really fucked up to think about the fact that Ronald Reagan, you know, the devil, thought the bombing of Beirut was too much. And now all we can get from let's call it Genocide Joe Biden, is just these moans. And I agree with you. I think these are like intentionally leaked just to save face, because I don't care how much someone moans if they're still sending, literally signing like billions of dollars and extra funding for military equipment for the Israelis to continue the genocide. So I just think, yeah, these parallels definitely exist and exist in the rhetoric and the actions and the tactics, and then also demonstrate how dire the situation is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's shown the pitfalls of international humanitarian law, right? And these international institutions, if we can't stop what's happening despite the blatant horror, right? I think we've moved well beyond this conflict, if you will, has unfolded in stages, right? At first, there was the fierce, visceral anger coming from, you know, many of the pro-Israel crowd at how October 7 unplayed. And I think from the other side, maybe there was a bit of shock almost, like, yeah, okay, you know, a few people, I think, in our camps would celebrate violence against civilians or the loss of civilian life. But I think there was almost kind of a shock at the outrage. It's like, well, considering all the things that have happened in recent years, all the attempts at peaceful protests that were repelled violently, at some point you knew there was going to be a violent reaction. And it's not to say that makes, you know, the loss of civilian life again any less palatable, but it was to such a level of, like, I don't know, maybe I should just speak personally here and say that I was almost taken aback by the viscerality of the reaction. You know, not the hurt for the loss of life, but the anger and the kind of like the bloodlust of response. You know, I think initially maybe that took me back a bit. And I think over time, as we've seen the destruction on the Palestinian side become more and more severe, and, you know, obviously Gaza is the worst part of this, but we can also talk about what's happening in the West Bank and what's happening in Jerusalem. And we can talk about, you know, the suppression of any sort of criticism of this war in a number of different countries. But I think that as that played out, you know, it became a point where suddenly there was this maybe ambivalence from people who had been kind of vocal about acknowledging the crimes that had been committed against people on October 7th. And then suddenly it just, like, or maybe not suddenly, but over time, it's become so beyond the pale for anyone, even apart from the most like fervent Zionist. And we've reached this point. And even now, to not be able to have any kind of action to, you know, to stop this. And in the sense that, you know, South Africa stepped up at the ICJ in an attempt to stop, you know, what is being called akin to genocide or could potentially be genocide, right? And despite all this, the reaction was not to slow it down or to check oneself or to suddenly, you know, start questioning funding towards the Israeli military. The reaction was to further punish and to intensify a lot of these operations. So I think this has left a lot of people in the Global South or people who have roots in the Global South questioning these sort of institutions. You know, I think for years and years, a lot of us have been not necessarily questioning these institutions, their validity, though that has widely happened. I think a lot of people have just asked for fair treatment, right? To actually apply international humanitarian law to everyone rather than just to those who fit the right demographics. I wrote a piece 2 years ago, shortly after the start of Ukraine. I don't know if you'll remember this. There was an outcry, essentially because there were a number of Black people, I think many of them were African students, though not exclusively, that were trying to flee from Eastern Ukraine. And they experienced, I mean, cases of racism, oftentimes by Ukrainian soldiers or civilians, kind of not prioritizing them, not listening to them, not taking their safety into consideration. And there was a big kind of outcry about this. I think some people grabbed on it in bad faith to kind of push an agenda that was maybe pro-Russian, anti-Ukraine, but there was also very widely, I think the majority of cases were genuinely good faith reporting on issues of racism, which are important. And you had kind of a reaction to that where people were saying, you know, now is not the time to talk about this. I wrote this piece at the time saying, there's never not a time to discuss or to critique racism. We should always talk about racism. That doesn't mean that, you know, Ukraine being invaded is merited, right? It doesn't mean that Ukraine does not have the right to defend itself, does not have the right to oppose an invasion. It doesn't mean that we should not lend solidarity to Ukrainians. But we must also be vigilant about cases of discrimination, and we have to call those out, and we have to work to build better societies. Now, the other side of that was that, you know, at this time, Ukrainians in Europe were getting, you know, first-class treatment as refugees or as displaced. And my argument in this piece was, this is not wrong. In fact, this is how all refugees should be treated. And again, you know, oftentimes what we're seeing in Europe when it comes to refugees coming from places like Afghanistan, like Syria, like Iraq, like the Global South, like parts of Africa, whether it's North or Central or East or West Africa, we're not seeing, I mean, obviously they're not getting first class treatment, but it's not just that, it's that the law itself is not being applied to them. They're violating asylum laws. And essentially what we're seeing here is this further degradation and this further erosion of international humanitarian law, because it's not being applied universally and to everyone. And so I think now, you know, the question is, how do we move forward in a world where these laws are not being applied to us as people who are trying to work in global solidarity? How do we try to enforce that these sort of universalist standards are applied to everyone? And what sort of avenues do we have to make this happen?
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, I think the double standards are completely there, and many people have been pointing them out in terms of how EU and American politicians talk about attacks on Ukrainian hospitals versus the complete denial. And there is a kind of really return to form for these kind of essentially imperialist nations or states, rather. I think it's a bit first step politics. But it really makes me think of, you know, the Orwell's conception of unpeople, that sort of general dehumanizing of just non-white people, the rest of the world. But I want to move back to your essay. And then also some of the things that you said. So we started this conversation because I had seen you write online about, you know, that there's so much more that you wanted to write, but obviously it's an Al Jazeera essay and there's like 1,000 words or 1,500, I'm not sure. Do you want to talk more about some of the interviews you've been doing post-essay?
Sure. I haven't been able to do as many as I would have liked. Where would you want to start?
I remember you told me a really interesting anecdote about a parrot.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if this was during the siege, to be honest, but I guess it must have been, because it was a time where there was bombings in West Beirut. You know, most of these anecdotes, or a lot of anecdotes, were passed to me through my dad. You know, you mentioned earlier that like a lot of our parents don't talk about the war. My dad did. He talked to me a lot about the war. There were a lot of things in his life that he didn't like to discuss, but his time covering, you know, the Lebanese Civil War was one of the things that he was happy to talk about, actually. Maybe part of that was because it was also his work. So yeah, there's a story about the parrot. What many journalists from that period may know, and actually there's an interesting podcast right now called Ma'bar. I don't know if you've heard it, Ayman. Essentially, what they did is they took people from all over the country and kind of didn't identify them, so they don't have any sort of sectarian or religious or political kind of identifiers, and just had them speak about their experiences, you know, common people. That was season one. They're going to go through other seasons. They've got kind of like a season 1.5 right now where they talk to journalists. And so a lot of my dad's old colleagues talk about this. And so they bring up this one place in particular called the Commodore Hotel. And you might be familiar with it. It's still there on what's known as Sharia Lyon, I think. And essentially all the journalists would go and hang out there and get drinks there in the evening because they had a basement bar. And so even if there was, you know, shelling or whatever, you were essentially safe. And there was this running gag, apparently, because there was a parrot there. And so whenever a new person would come to the bar and they'd hear, you know, the whistle, you could hear the whistle of the shell about to fall. So they would dive under the bar. And so you'd hear kind of the whistle coming. And at the end, they'd hear just this very tame kind of sound like this. And what had happened was, is the parrot had learned how to mimic the whistle of the shell falling so accurately that people thought it was real. So if they didn't know that the parrot was there making the noise, they would dive under the bar only to kind of hear the at the end, and then the rest of the bar would kind of break out until after. And so that was one of the many, like, you know, moments of charm that were, you know, through what was obviously a very difficult period, especially for those who didn't have shelters, because shelters weren't widespread. But, you know, there were anecdotes like this as well.
Yeah, the reason that I find this a very interesting and telling anecdote is because, like you said, there is in some times, in some ways, a sentimentality for this period that is very interesting, and that obviously this is a huge, like, disparallel, or because, yeah, I don't think anyone's going to be telling stories from Gaza about what's happening now with any, like, oh, there was this funny little thing. A part of that, I wonder why that is. And a part of it might be, you know, that Beirut did resist and it did push out the occupier and it did kick Israel out and eventually Lebanon as a whole. And so I wonder if we experienced a greater defeat, maybe we wouldn't have. Because, yeah, I do think about the fact that my parents didn't tell me anything and they refused to. And there's almost...
Well, yeah, look, I mean, you know, I think... No experience is universal, right? Like, different people have different experiences. And this story of the parrot is humorous and stuff like that, but it's also one of, again, you know, like, an enormous amount of privilege in a sense. It's weird to say that. There's people who had enormous amount of privilege under, you know, shelling, but there's a truth in the sense that these people were the ones who could afford and could find, you know, shelter in a sense. And there's a number of people who couldn't. And obviously a lot of people were killed. And I'm sure if you talk to those people, there won't be that space for those, you know, humorous or charming anecdotes. I think the thing what we're seeing in Gaza, for example, is just the destruction is so widespread, right? Like, we've now read that up to 60% of buildings have been, you know, if not partially, completely damaged. You know, more than 1% of the population has been killed. The number of children that have been killed, the things that we've read on, you know, whether it's in a news story or on Twitter, or the images we've seen with our own eyes through social media are so beyond horrific. And a lot of those images were things that people would see coming out of Beirut at the time too. But I think it's the level of destruction, one. And another thing people told me is that it's the updated technology. So the weapons that were being used to hit Beirut in 82 are nowhere near as deadly or precise, or in some cases, you know, purposefully imprecise as those that are being used today, right? There's been a lot of stories coming out about how the Israelis are using AI to generate targets. So I think in that way, you know, yeah, I mean, one, you and I are two Lebanese people who had Lebanese parents who are telling us from a position whereby, you know, I don't want to speak to individual suffering, but the likelihood is that there was maybe less constant attacks on them than there were on parts of the Palestinian camps. You know, at the same time, I went to visit a friend of my dad's recently. My father passed away in August of 2022. He was 70 years old, so not that old. But I went to, you know, he told me a lot of stories over the years. But after you lose a parent, and to anyone who has, I think what you realize is that you have this thing in your head where you know all their stories, but suddenly they kind of dissipate and the details get a bit foggy and the dates start to melt together. So I went to talk to one of his old colleagues who was with him at United Press International at the time. Her name's Mona Ziyade, and her husband, Ed Blanche, was also a journalist. He passed away a few years ago himself. But so Mona and my dad worked together at the time. And she told me how, you know, the first time they had hit Hamra was this time where they were trying to hit I think it was the Minister of Information. And so at that time, the UPI office was in the Nahar office. And at that time, I don't know, Ayman, if you know where the Dar Nahar is today on Hamra Main Street. Before, Nahar had this big building in downtown that kind of overlooks the sea. They had I think it was like a 5-story or 6-story building in Hamra. And on the fourth floor was the United Press International building. So when they heard the first, because again, like, the Israelis would hit in kind of, I guess, like, hits of four. So you'd kind of have these four tuck, 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 tuck kind of hits with short spaces in between them. At this time, they knew they had to get out and at least go try to get below ground. My father, in one of these times, had ran into his office to grab his cameras, you know, which were quite heavy at the time. And the impact of one of the blasts that was trying to hit the Ministry of Information, apparently, hit outside the office or maybe even hit the office itself and propelled him forward. And he was the last one. The rest of the people had run down the stairs, including my mother, who was in the office that day. And this hit had propelled him forward, essentially, and he ended up breaking his leg, I think, in two or three places, and then had to continually kind of like run up and down the stairs. And what Mona told me is that, the next day or a day or two later, they had to evacuate and try to get out of West Beirut. They got the order to evacuate at that point. And to get across, they had to go through some pretty harrowing experiences of crawling across sand dunes at the Galeri Sema'an crossing. And so, I mean, you know, it's interesting that, you know, my father was wounded, I think, two or three times in the war. He was never shot, but there was this shell that led to him breaking his leg through the impact of the fall. And another time he was driving and a shell fell and he ended up driving into a wall and then had his front two teeth dangling by the nerve. And he said that was probably the most painful experience of his life. And essentially having lived through those things and having been, you know, wounded through those things, he had two fake teeth for the rest of his life. His front two teeth were fake for the rest of his life. He still was able to kind of tell stories of, you know, funny things that had happened and stuff like that. I'm not sure if other people will have shared that experience, but it is an interesting thing to think about in terms of, you know, your position. And again, you know, I spoke to a few people who had told me there really was a sentiment during that period of hope, of resistance, of, you know, solidarity. And I think that I don't know if that had anything to do as well with the international response. But I think today what we're seeing a lot of despair. We're seeing a lot of, you know, a lot of organizers and a lot of people are coming out and saying, and rightfully saying, we cannot give up. And I agree with that. You know, I've had my own moments of despair, but I think that we cannot stop fighting because what other choice do we have? But you're seeing a lot of people kind of despair and say that everything we've done until now has still not been able to stop this. And with all the awareness, with all the documentation, and you mentioned Syria before, you know, Aleppo and other places, Syria is probably the most well-documented war, you know, in modern history, if not in history in general. And to still not be able to gather the political will to protect a group of people being just, you know, eradicated is, it's a terrifying thing, no?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree in terms of, I mean, the levels of despair and the propensity towards despair, but then also the need to resist it because despair is a sort of form of defeat. But the reason that I brought up and I wanted you to tell the parrot story and why I find such a story interesting is in terms of even for these privileged, like for those that survived, and obviously anyone who survived a war is in some weird way privileged, but it's like, how narration and how history and how our parents tell us history or like generations pass history on. I was recently reading an essay about a book by a Palestinian writer, Radwa Ashour. I think the book is called The Woman from Tanturo. In the book, she's, I think the protagonist is talking to her grandmother and asks her, and she's writing down, you know, she's sort of doing sort of a journalism thing. And asking her mother, her grandmother, who lived through Sabra Shatila's massacre, and then asked her, so tell me about the massacre. And the grandmother says, leave that page blank. You know, there's like a, with my parents' refusal to talk to me about the war, they wanted to protect me, obviously. They wanted to raise a generation that was sort of freed from the traumas of it. Obviously, that's a futile effort because the traumas really ingrained and permeates the society. But so I think because obviously the violence of war continues intergenerationally and perpetuates. And I think by trying to not tell us about it, there was an attempt to save us from essentially from despair or from trauma. I think one of the saddest things for my parents is that they couldn't save us from those types of traumas, you know? There was this feeling where it's like, we really try to protect you, but like Lebanon, you know, this is just Lebanon, like not Syria, not Palestine. Yeah, I don't know. There's obviously sometimes a bit of a denial or a bit of a, like a necessary delusion. Again, like the only stories I have ever heard from the war, you know, some of them my grandmother tells me, they're morbid, but they're always, there's like a bit of humor. There's like an insistence on it. And it's like this one story my grandmother tells me often of like that kind of, there was heavy shelling in Beirut, so they went to the mountains. And then the day they got to the mountains, there was heavy shelling there. So then, and then when they went to their like, you know, maternal mountains, you know, which was calm, there was nothing. But the day they arrived, shelling over there. And so, yeah, I do think about how this history forms a kind of these narratives that are intentional, like not just the narratives of what happened necessarily, you know, it's not just facts, but it's like, how does my grandmother want me to remember her as a person in the war, you know, or remember the war itself? And that's why I find these stories, not necessarily because they have to be funny, and not necessarily because like they're better for being funny or like good for them for having a sense of humor, but it's more like there's an intent there, and there's an attempt at, because all of their agency, or rather so much of their agency is stripped by the fact that, you know, they are being attacked by warplanes, you know, and you're kind of defenseless against these warplanes. But what you can do, you still can have agency over how you recount it, how you narrate it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it fleshes out, you know, we are more than victims. You know, we're humans with a fully fleshed out lives and identities and communities. And, you know, I think you're really hitting on something there in the sense that, I guess that's it. We are more than just victims. And I think people want to show that. They want to show that they're more than just this. And I think that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about dehumanization. I've said this a few times now to different people. I'm not convinced. I think to be dehumanized, you have to have first been seen as human. And I'm not sure that people in our region have ever really truly been humanized by a lot of, I guess, the Orientalist gaze or the Western gaze, if you will. And so I think that, you know, a lot of this is also showing that we are more than just victims. Like, yeah, we do have agency. It doesn't mean that you know, you can single-handedly have the power to duck a bomb or to run between them or dance between them, right? It just means that we're more than our pain. We're also joy. We're also love. We're also all these other sort of complex emotions. I think that's a really important thing. You know, when you talk about like how our parents don't want to talk about some of the things that had happened, that doesn't change the fact that they carry trauma. It doesn't change the fact that they pass down trauma, right? And we know that trauma can also skip generations sometimes. There are studies that show that grandparents can pass down trauma to their grandchildren. And so, you know, I think that when you're talking about this idea of narrative versus facts and everything else, a lot of the issues that we have in Lebanon today can maybe be taken back to the fact that we've got these strong emotions and these narratives are still very cantonized, right? They're very, you know, one side, parts of the country may see a certain figure as a savior and others see them as a, you know, as something else. You mentioned Bashir Jamil before, who has a lot of, I mean, there's still a big poster of him in Sassine Square, right? A percentage of the population still widely adores this man. When I spoke to a member of the civil defense forces, and he was telling me about his experience in Sabra and Shatila, and that was part of the, you know, that was post-siege. So I didn't get to it in my piece. You know, I've written other pieces since with my colleague Matt Nashid about Sabra and Shatila survivors. But I spoke to this guy named Ziad Kaj, who was a part of the civil defense force in his late teens, early 20s when Sabra and Shatila happened. And he told me at the time, you know, in West Beirut, people used to whisper Jamil's name and call him the boogeyman, you know? So much has been hidden from us. And a lot of us are now going back and trying to learn and also unlearn a bunch of things that have happened in the past or things that were told to us in the past. You know, I used to think that maybe, you know, what we need are facts and what we need is truth. And I don't think that's necessarily untrue, but I think going forward, you know, looking into history, it's also important to take into account people's traumas and what they live through. Whatever is factual about intent of certain groups or political actors, other people will have lived through things that put them in a certain way, that made them feel a certain way. And I think we need to deal with these emotions, right? I think I'm getting onto a kind of a tangent now, but...
I think I have a Toni Morrison quote from the exact same essay that I quoted from earlier, where she says that one of the most important things in her writing, she says, "The crucial distinction for me is not the distinction between fact and fiction, but the distinction between fact and truth."
Mm-hmm.
So because, again, it's not just that our parents didn't tell us these things because they didn't want us to feel the trauma, but that they didn't want us to repeat the same mistakes of their generation. So, like, my parents refused to talk about West Beirut and East Beirut. You know, Beirut is still a divided city in many ways, but there's sort of this, we don't want you to fall into the same, like, sectarian cycle of violence, and so we're just not going to tell you anything because we don't want to raise another generation that'll do another war, essentially. Or that's how I've been thinking about it in some ways. Like, they want to protect us.
I think everyone has their reasons. And I think, yeah, for a lot of parents, it was to protect their kids in one way or another. It was either because you just won't be political or, you know, but there's other families who do talk about it, and they talk about it in ways. I think everyone's main focus post-war was to protect their, you know, their kids. But yeah, those, like, I mean, the Morrison quote hits it on the head, because essentially, you know, the narratives differ from neighborhood to neighborhood, and they are taken as truths, right? These aren't facts. There's things that you can say with total comfort in parts of town that you can't say on the other part of town, you know, always. I mean, I don't want to paint it as some sort of, you know, stricter than it is, but yeah. Yeah.
But I think there's one final quote, and I've been thinking a lot about Mu'tez, the Palestinian journalist, and there's one thing that he did or that he wrote when he was photographing, I think this was in November, like the first photographs of like Nakba 2.0, you know, of like mass movements of Palestinians from the north to the south. And he's photographing this historic, horrible, horrendous, just god-awful thing that's happening to his people. And he writes, "I hate that I'm the one to be documenting this. You know, I hate that I'm taking these photos." And it's, I was thinking a lot about this when you were talking about that we're more than just victims, because I hear Palestinians say this so much, where it's like, "I don't want to take a photo of my dead daughter. I don't want to take the surgeon who operated on his daughter in the living room without anesthesia, like amputating her leg."
Yeah.
And they publicize this video. And this is just like I think a very universal thing, but even more so for Arabs, where we have so much pride. And it's like, you know, you don't want to show yourself in town with like greasy hair, let alone show the world, like, "Look, we're suffering, we're miserable." But there's this feeling of, you know, we need support, we need solidarity, we need action, we need someone to stop this. So they send out these broadcasts and they send out these horrific things, but obviously to no avail, or to very little avail.
You know, Ayman, the other day I was clicking through a YouTube video, and there was this one that was like, I watched this video on the Palestinian dialect. There was this presenter in the video, and she was going around and just kind of asking people something simple, like, "What country would you like to travel to?" And it took me a minute. And then suddenly I realized that the host, like the host of the video, if you will, was Bisan. I don't know her family name, but I think the one name would resonate with a lot of people through her work on Instagram and other social media outlets. And it was just very kind of this really sharp contrast between, as you've seen her now, you know, hair often pulled back and speaking with great purpose. And at that time, where she was full of life and energy, you know, she didn't want to be a journalist in this sense, Motaz, you know, used to take photos of beautiful things, like of sunsets. If you go further back, far back enough on his Instagram account, you see it, the stuff that he used to take photographs of. None of these people, this wasn't the things, you know, there were journalists in Gaza that did this, but these ones in particular, some of the ones that have become the biggest, are not, this was not their intent. You know, in Beirut at the time, like imagine if the top food blogger today became a war correspondent. That's, it's maddening to think about. You know, at the time there were international Western media outlets here. There were local, there were dozens and dozens of newspapers here. You know, there was access to many things. And I mean, we didn't have the pervasiveness or the democratization of media the way that we do today, but many things got covered. And got covered by people who, you know, had chosen that line of, it's not to say that it wasn't, I'm sure there was a number of people who fell into it because it was a job that paid money at the time, you know, but to see this is crazy. And Motaz wrote something on his social media, I think just yesterday, kind of saying that he's not, you know, he's obviously outside of Gaza now, but that he can't sleep, he can't eat, you know, nothing's, he's got these constant sentiments, like this constant horrible feeling within him. I mean, this is probably the preconditioning or the, you know, what comes before PTSD, as PTSD takes some time to settle in, right? You know, my dad, until later on in his life, used to sometimes wake up screaming from things that he had seen during covering war. And the intensity, I think, of what's been happening in Gaza is so much that, you know, there was, I forget which UN agency came out and essentially said that probably every child in Gaza today is, you know, experiencing extreme trauma. And the thing is, you can't treat trauma until it's past, like until the action is over. So we're in this period where I think that, you know, the way that a lot of our parents lived and inhaled trauma and then have, it's a generational thing. It passes on and it passes on and it passes on. And it's a great privilege to be born and raised without having that in your blood. So where that leaves us today is it's just, I want to leave people with that idea of, you know, again, imagine your favorite influencer, your favorite blogger, your favorite media personality, who's not a war reporter, who's not a journalist by trade, is forced into this kind of documentation, right?
And incredibly young.
Yeah, they're all in their early 20s, right? I think Motaz is 24. Plastia was 21, 22, you know. And then not to mention what somebody like Walid Ahdouh, who is a, you know, who is a journalist and is a, you know, a lion of a journalist, like what he's gone through, losing his mother, losing his children, losing a grandchild, losing his wife, you know. And to, you know, I'm really not one of these people who's like, you know, you take a hit and then you keep going and you persevere, like you must do. No, I think, like, you know, like perseverance is great, but people should also recognize when there's time to take off. But when you're in such a situation, I'm not sure what else he could do, right? Like in the continuing attempt to eradicate your people, what else could he do but carry on in that sense? You know, I think any journalism award that doesn't go to the journalists of Gaza this year is a joke, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. No, it's true. I think it's impossible to talk about mental health in such conditions and situations. And, you know, they themselves have spoken a lot about this. Like, people ask Plastia, people ask Bissan and Motaz, like, how are you doing mentally? And it's like the most absurd question for them. They're like, what are you talking about? Like, I have no mental health. Like, it's gone. Like, what? Like, and so the only time you can ever potentially even consider it is once you're sort of out of an immediate war genocide situation. Mm-hmm. But then even then, it still is really painful. It's incredibly, incredibly, incredibly painful.
Well, and I want, sorry to cut you off. I just want to say one thing here, which is that where, what do you imagine the pain to have thoroughly documented the things that are happening to you, right? Like it's beyond a doubt now, to the point that international legal bodies are taking action, that this is something that can be stopped, that we allow to continue to happen as an international community. So you've done everything. You've debased yourself by showing your most intimate personal moments, your community's most lowest moments of women screaming, of men crying, of charred bodies, of limbs everywhere, of destruction, of the worst and the best of humanity side by side. And you've done all this for months on end, and it's not enough to stop it. I mean, my question is, how do we, like, in a way, how do you come back from that, right? How do you build up enough faith in humanity to kind of carry on and carry forward? I think this is going to be the biggest challenge that we have as, people who believe in humanity moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, I recently read an essay by Edward Said from the late 70s entitled Zionism from the Perspective of Its Victims. And already then he's describing how the sheer violence, the brutality, the cruelty of Zionism makes it such that it closes, it's continuously closing any avenues for empathy, for a different whatever, for anything other than just monstrosity.
Yeah, and this will continue too, right? Like, Frantz Fanon has written how the colonizer as well as the colonized suffer from such dynamics. Albert Memmi has written about this as well, that while, you cannot compare the suffering of people here, but it'll have an impact on the occupiers' society as well, in terms of not just the people, I mean, particularly probably the people who are on the ground actively committing the violence, but across the society as well. And we've seen that in years as Israeli society has pushed more to the right. We're seeing that now as, what is essentially cross segments of different political leanings block aid trucks into Gaza. This violence is going to be repeated and it's going to continue. And, again, we lived it in 82 and people have lived it since, and we're living it again today. And I think it's a very heavy, very heavy prospect.
Indeed. The hardest thing to do these days is have any of these conversations, and you tend to kind of want to sum it up in some way that's positive or actionable, or like there's some conclusion, but there is no conclusion. We have no idea what's going to happen today and tomorrow and what the effects of all these things are. And especially since we're talking about something that isn't new, it's a new level. It's a new escalation, but it's the Nakba 2.0, as many are saying. For some Palestinians, it's the seventh, it's the eighth Nakba. But the violence in the region as a whole, or the Zionist colonization, it's a 100-year process. 1885, I think, was the first Zionist settlement. And we're talking about 1982, which sure is 41 years ago, but it's, the same entities. It's when we talk about, like you said, when we talk about Hezbollah now, they are a product of the 1982 Israeli invasion, which actually also, even the 82 invasion, they'd invaded in 78, just didn't go as far as Beirut. And there'd already been skirmishes even before. And all these histories are still very much so still happening. It's not just context. It's not just justification or just narrative, like stories. It is something that is still lived. And again, that's why I think watching some of these documentaries, we're recording this episode on the 16th of February. So like on the 18th of February, I'm screening a film, Children of Shatilo, 1998. And still very familiar, but also really shows that this is a very long process, and that these tactics and that this violence has a very long history, and it builds up. And I have no idea what the future holds for Palestinians, for our region.
Yeah, I think it's important that we often learn that history are the things that happened before. And people say that we learn history so that we don't repeat it. But I think we need to understand that history is not just what happened before. It's why things are the way they are today, right? And so, like you mentioned, there have been multiple steps within the Nakba, but it's one continuous process. It's one continuous act that's now being further pushed on today. I think, you know, if there's anything that can give us hope, it's that, you know, our grandparents saw a free Palestine. Our grandparents saw a region where you could take trains between or buses between different stops in the region. You know, you could take a bus from Beirut all the way down to Cairo and then into North Africa, or you could take it into the Gulf. And today we're at one of the worst points where, you know, if you're in Lebanon, you're essentially landlocked. Unless you're somebody who can travel through Syria, though a lot of people can't and wouldn't, right? So my hope is that, you know, while just over 100 years ago, you could do those things, maybe in 100 years, the world can be radically changed again. You know, it's not always super hopeful or moving in the best of directions, but the world can radically reshape. The world can radically reshape. And while we've been moving in a bad direction, you know, our individual actions can, if channeled well and you know, connect with others, we can enact important changes, you know. And so I guess my hope would be that maybe I won't get to see it in my lifetime, but I hope that, you know, the generation that is what will be, you know, our children or our children's children will be able to have that kind of liberty and dignity and be able to experience that.
Thank you for that. I wouldn't have been able to formulate anything as powerful a kind of conclusion for this episode. There is a nice sentiment in the fact that if you look further back into history, that the future opens up new possibilities.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't ask you about three books beforehand, but if you have anything that you're reading or that you'd want to sort of plug, now would be the time.
Yeah, I may have plugged these before. I'm not sure. Actually, the last sentiment comes from, yeah, so Ala Abdel Fattah's book, Not Yet Been Defeated, which is a series of letters that he essentially wrote from prison, I think is crucial to anybody who is trying to maintain hope and you know, have this wider view of the struggle. I also think that he's a very pertinent thinker in the way that his different moments in jail and coming out of jail and experiencing the world with kind of fresh eyes at times is very useful. But it's also like a radical means of hope. What other books could I give at the moment? There's always Kamal Salibi's House of Many Mansions.
That's on my short list.
Yeah, I mean, that's, for me, it's probably the best history book written about Lebanon. Particularly in that it addresses this question of fact versus truth, which you so adequately pulled from Toni Morrison. It discusses essentially different narratives over time, kind of fact checks them, but also shows how myths become important over time, right? How they essentially become someone's truth. So that's a good one for the context of Lebanon. I also recently read Tariq Baone's book on Hamas, and that's a great, you know, academic read for essentially anyone who wants to know about the history of how Hamas has acted, chosen to act, why they've chosen to do what they've done. Obviously, I think the book was published a few years ago now, maybe 2019, if I'm not mistaken, or 2021, possibly. But it's a few years old now. But it still, you know, goes from their genesis all the way up until recent years, and why they've acted, kind of, or the decisions they've taken through their own explanations, as he thoroughly researched different newspapers and articles written by, you know, Hamas journalists and things like that. I think, yeah, I mean, these are things that have shaped my knowledge of the region and shaped my thinking towards this particular subject. I always like to throw in some fiction. And in that case, I might say something like Najib Bakhti's Between Beirut and the Moon, or Rawi Hajj's De Niro's Game, or Hellfire Society is another good one. All of these kind of show, I guess, to me, I mean, different stages and different times. Rawi Hajj tends to deal more with the Civil War, whereas Najib's book is more contemporary, I'd say like late aughts to early 2010s, kind of goes up through the start of the Syrian Civil War. But fiction often tells us things that nonfiction or history cannot, And I think it's important to see, again, like to see the range and the humanity of a people. I recently picked up, I hosted an episode a little while ago, and Karim Safiyuddin recommended Hawastra Bulsi's latest book, Zaman Yadisar Jadid. And I picked that up and I'm slowly working my way through it.
Nice. I remember that suggestion. Yeah, these are a lot of things to read that are on my now very long short list.
Yeah, get to it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much for this, Justin. I thought this was a really wonderful conversation, if not a bit difficult at times.
Yeah. Thanks, Simon. Thanks for the opportunity and for sticking to this as we talked about it for long periods of time and now made it happen. Appreciate it.